and rest?
Sir Benita sat. She watched Marianne empty the cart, a whirlwind of vigorous, chaotic activity.
The war had not changed her as much as it had everyone else. She was still an enigma to Benita, a woman capable of tracking Martine to some obscure Nazi hideaway, but incapable of managing her own hair. When Benita first married Connie, she had marveled at the woman's paradoxes. Marianne loved to entertain, but cared nothing about food or fashion. She would slave away preparing the house for a fabulous party, only to come down wearing last year's dowdy dress. She would invite the most distinguished members of the Foreign Office and Intelligence Corps to dinner, and then serve her cooks homely sauerbraten and Wildschweining goulash. She was an abstracted, disorganized mother to her children, but an organized and efficient manager of adults. She was not a beauty with her strong, almost mannish features and high cheekbones. "A falcon face," Benita had once said to Connie and been thoroughly scolded. But she was compelling, and in moments, her face achieved a kind of graceful symmetry that was striking. It was a face you could not easily forget. At the salons and weekend parties Marianne and Albrecht hosted in the beginning of the war, Benita had watched the handsome barons and counts and noble youths of Germany's most aristocratic families hang on Marianne's every word. They had jousted playfully in a style of speaking that made Benita feel stupid. Were they joking or serious? Teasing her or mocking one another? In the presence of Connie's fancy friends, Benita had found language an obstacle rather than a bridge to connection. But for Marianne it seemed a smooth and direct road that always rose to meet her feet.
"Why, you're still in your night clothes," Marianne exclaimed, glancing up from the vegetables she was unloading. "Did you find the clothing I left in your room?"
Benita blushed. She had risen in such haste and completely forgotten to dress.
"I'm sorry. I was rushing."
"Sorry, Posh? Nothing to be sorry for. It just doesn't seem like you.
But then, of course, no one can be expected to be like themselves anymore, can they?"
Marianne lifted the cart by its handles and pushed it back out the kitchen door.
"As long as you have what you need."
At that moment, Marianne's two daughters appeared in the doorway, carrying a bucket between them.
"Just in time," Marianne cried. "We have milk for you, Tante Benita."
Benita was not sure which surprised her more, the presence of milk or the title Tante, aunt.
Somehow, lowly Benita Gruber, last of a long line of toiling Westphalian peasants, had become Tante to the von Lingenfels girls.
"Say hello, girls, and introduce yourselves," Marianne instructed.
The girls approached, dark-haired and tall, maybe 10 and 12. Katharina and Elisabeth. And Benita remembered their two little heads peering down at the guests from the landing on the stairs at the Countess's party. She had wished so fervently to have a daughter like them. A sweet girl to dress in dirndls and christen in delicate frothy white. It seemed quaint now. An innocent dream. Who would want to introduce a girl to this world? Thank God Martin was a boy.
"Here,"
said Katharina, the younger of the two, as she dipped a cup into the bucket and extended it to Benita.
"It's delicious."
She had a sweet, shy manner about her, with long, thick eyelashes and awkward, cultish limbs.
"Where is Martin?"
the older girl, Elisabeth, asked. She was the sharper of the two in both look and tone.
"Out in the courtyard. You didn't see him?"
Benita sprang up to look. The puddle was now abandoned.
"He was with Fritz, playing..."
She started toward the door, but was stopped by Marianne.
"Let him be," Marianne commanded. "It's good for a boy to be free."
Taking in Benita's face, she softened her voice.
All is very safe here, Benita. Really.
In her room, Benita pulled on the battered brassiere and the vest that she had washed and worn so many times its seams were nearly gone. The drops of blood across the belly now faded to innocent-looking brown splotches. She found a wash basin and a pitcher of water on an otherwise empty shelf. She splashed some on her face and pulled back her poor brittle hair, knotting it at the nape of her neck. And there was a loud rap on the door.
"I'm leaving shoes here for you," Marianne's voice said. "See if they fit."
Benita's own were a badly worn pair of boots she had stolen from a bombed-out flat that she had joined the women of her building in combing through. No one asked what had become of its inhabitants, lying dead under the rubble of the bombing, or safe in the countryside, or killed in a concentration camp. The shoes had been cheap to begin with, and were now nearly worn through. Benita waited until Marianne's footsteps receded to retrieve the new boots. They were certainly the finest she had ever come into contact with. Dark green, barely worn, with an elegant, distinguished heel. The leather was soft and smooth, and against it, her finger felt monstrously chapped. They were too fine for a woman with such hands. The kind of boots she had once dreamed of wearing. It seemed a cruel joke that this would be that day. "Be careful of what you wish for," they seemed to taunt. She could not put them on. When she emerged, dressed, Martin sat at the kitchen table between Elisabeth and Katerina. His mouth was stained with raspberry juice, his eyes round at the sight of so much food.
"Ah, that's better,"
Marianne said of the clean white shirt and wool skirt Benita now wore.
"The shoes didn't fit."
"No," Benita lied. Suddenly there was a gurgling sound from Martin, and the little boy's face turned red. On either side of him the girls blanched.
"Oh,"
Benita exclaimed, feeling his shame as if it were her own. Of course his poor belly was not used to all this fruit. He had probably eaten God knows how many bowls of porridge, and now the berries and whatever else. The stink was putrid, full of the bile of a dysfunctional gut.
"The poor boy," Marianne said. "We should not have fed you so much."
She held out a hand to him, taking charge in her usual calm, confident way.
"We will have to find you a new pair of pants."
Slowly, humiliatingly, Martin rose, the back of his pants stained and the stench growing worse.
"Come," Marianne nicked her head. "I know just the thing." "Benita," she added over her shoulder, "would you give that pot a stir?"
Benita nodded and watched as Marianne disappeared with her son. Chapter 2. Thuringia. Late May 1945. In the children's home, Martin Konstantin Fledermann was not Martin's name. He was Martin Schmidt, just as Berthold von Stauffenberg was Berthold Meister, and Liesel Stravitsky was Liesel Falkmann, and so on. All the children were given good, ordinary German names, and the shameful thing was that Martin had almost forgotten he was a Fledermann. There were many things he had forgotten in the children's home. His father, for example, the shadowy figure Marianne later referred to as a hero and his mother never mentioned, and life before the war, before air raid sirens and nights spent in the cellar, before the deafening roar of low-flying bomber planes. But there were things he remembered in the home, too. How he'd arrived, for instance. A long train trip on a military transport. The pockmarked face of his SS chaperone. And the salty, tangy taste of dried meat on his tongue. It was the first time he had ever tasted such a thing. Warm and a little gritty from its home in the SS man's pocket. He had thrown up afterward, holding his head out the window of the moving train, so that the vomit spewed back in his face.
He also remembered the sunny flat in Berlin, air thick with dust motes, and the view over the shady, elegant Mersteinstrasse, with its pale stucco buildings and café on the corner, and the warmth of his mother's body curled against his at night in bed, the cameo pendant that hung in the hollow of her throat, the words of the song she would sing to him.
Kommt ein Vogel geflogen, setzt sich nieder auf mein Fuß, hat ein Sätel im Schnabel, von der Mutter ein Gruß.
A little bird comes flying, sits down on my foot, has a letter in its beak, from my mother a kiss. But at the children's home there was no bird, no letter, and no kiss. The home was not all bad, though. It was a cozy stucco house outside a village in the foothills of the mountains. It had a pleasant garden full of fruit trees and flowers, a broken fountain, and a high brick wall. The children were not allowed to leave.
Frau Wortmüller, the potato-faced grandmother in charge of the place, was not unkind. She was firm and orderly and saw to it that her charges were bathed and clothed and fed. Every night she played the recorder for them. Sorrowful folk ballads about poor miller's daughters and princes, witches and resourceful neglected youngest sons. These were sweeter, softer melodies than the Nazi-endorsed songs the children learned from Herr Stuper, who supervised their re-education. He taught them The Rotten Bones Are Trembling, The Horst Wessel Song, and Germany Awake, all full of verses about blood, slavery, and revenge, politics, and war. Every day, Frau Wortmüller wore the same tweed skirt and green jacket with a Nazi Mutterkreuz, which she had been awarded for bearing 8 children on the lapel. 4 of these were dead, 2 killed in the war, 1 dead at birth, and another who had succumbed in an institution for the feeble-minded. Frau Wortmüller hung this one's picture in the pantry, where she could see his face every time she pulled out the ingredients for supper. Of those living, her sons had not yet returned from wherever they'd been fighting, and her daughters were married mothers themselves. Martine found the Mutterkreuz pin beautiful, with its gold points and shiny blue inset, and the pride with which she rubbed it clean and wrapped it in a handkerchief every morning lent it an almost holy significance. In the weeks after the war ended, Frau Wortmüller, a religious woman, began to speak to the children about God. Once she was the only supervisor left at the children's home. Herr Stuper had taken off at the first sign of the Americans. Who was there to reprimand her? The Americans, who held church every Sunday in their barracks and wore crosses underneath their uniforms. She included Bible readings and nightly prayers in the children's bedtime routine. Herr Stuper would have reported her. He had taught them about racial purity and German Heimat and the divine wisdom of their Führer, and had no patience for what he called Christian superstitions. Mostly, the children hated him. Although he had led them on a few wonderful hikes in the mountains and let them listen to Nazi-endorsed radio programs, Martin grew to love one song that was played often, Erika, which he understood to be a folksy ballad about a flower and a pair of childhood sweethearts, until Liesel Falkman whispered to him that singing along to it was as bad as spitting on his father's grave. Martin did not understand this. How could it be like spitting on his father's grave? The fathers and mothers of the children in the home had made mistakes, he understood. Now they were dead, and it was Frau Wortmüller's and Herr Stulper's job to get them ready for new families, rich, powerful Nazi families, who would teach them to be good Germans. Bullshit, Liesel said. Our mothers aren't dead. They're in prisons or concentration camps.
For what? Martin asked.
For plotting to kill Hitler, Dummkopf,
Martine was filled with shame. For plotting to kill the Führer, who Frau Furtmüller assured him in many ways was all-knowing, kind, and good. His own mother and father had done this?
At 11, Liesl had a wider, darker sense of the world than Martin.
When Frau Furtmüller extinguished the candles at night, Liesl would climb into Martin's bed and whisper secrets. She was not supposed to be in the home with the others. Her parents were communists, not aristocrats. Her bloodlines did not date back to Frederick the Great or Bismarck, or anyone else of national significance.
But somehow, when her parents were taken by the Gestapo, Liesl had been brought here.
Maybe because she was pretty and blonde and blue-eyed. This, Martin understood. Liesl was the prettiest girl he knew. She would make a good child for an important Nazi family. Wasn't she happy, then, that they had made this mistake?
No, Liesl would scowl at him when he asked such questions.
She didn't want to live with Nazi pigs. Then, suddenly, it seemed Liesl was right. Their mothers were alive. The first to arrive was Adalbert Schneddings, a gaunt, hollow-cheeked woman with a dark-haired baby in her arms. She had cried and cried as she held her son, stuffing his face against her belly as if, rather than reuniting, they were saying goodbye. And then others came in batches, Klaus and Gretel's glamorous aunt from England, who was taking them to their mother in Switzerland, the Becker's sweet, tired mother straight out of solitary confinement in Ravensbrück, the Hunzer's mother by way of a fancy American Armed Forces escort car. At first, Martin's heart had leapt every time the gate bell chimed. His mother. He thought of her blonde head bent over the game of marbles they would play, her fine strands of hair catching the sun, and the tight grip of her hand as she walked beside him past the bombed fountain to the Apotheke, or the market. He recalled how it felt to press his face against the stiffly washed fabric of her dress, and underneath it, the softness of her breast. But Martin's mother did not come, and neither did Liesl's.
"My little sparrows," Frau Furtmüller called them, looking increasingly worried.
It was the beginning of June. Her youngest daughter, Magda, had come to stay with them, along with her two mean little boys, who called them traitors' spawn.
"Why don't you throw them out?"
Martin overheard Magda ask her mother one night.
"The war is over. Your responsibility here is finished."
From then on, Martin was extra careful. He did not want to be thrown out. And he knew it was true. Frau Furtmüller did not have to stay with them anymore. There was no one commanding or paying her to do so.
"She just wants the extra rations,"
Liesl said. But he did not believe this. In her way, he thought, Frau Furtmüller loved them. And then one day, a tall, stern-faced lady named Marianne von Lingenfels arrived. With her cape and high boots, she reminded Martin of a toy soldier.
"Is that your mother?"
Liesl whispered, watching through the window with him as the woman strode up the path. Then they heard her in the foyer. She had a loud, clear voice that carried up the tile stairway. She had come to claim Martin Fledermann. The sound of his name crackled inside like a spark along dormant wires.
Martin Fledermann. Of course, that was his name.
She was a friend of the family. She would take him to find his mother in Berlin. Beside Martin, Liesl grew still. She would be alone if he left. Martin could see her thinking this too. The woman strode into the room. Frau Furtmüller scrambling behind her, wheezing up the stairs and looking alarmed.
"Martin Fledermann,"
the woman announced, clapping her hands together. She had a long, intelligent face and startlingly bright brown eyes. Her hair was pulled back severely.
"Marianne von Lingenfels," she said,
bending to his level and extending her hand.
"You don't remember me?" Your father was my dear friend.
Martine stared back at her.
And who is this?
The woman straightened, and her eyes moved to take in Liesel, whose pretty face grew petulant.
Liesel,
Frau Fortmuller said, pausing.
Stravitsky?
She cast a nervous look in the girl's direction. It was not a name Martine had heard before.
Ah.
Frau von Lingenfels frowned.
What was your father's name, child?
Bartosz,
Liesel mumbled. And then, seeming to consider something, she looked up.
Did you know my mother? Johanna. Is she alive?
Frau von Lingenfels looked uncertain.
I don't know,
she said, finally.
I didn't know her.
Martin had never heard these names, but he understood something he could not put into words, and reached over to take hold of Liesel's hand.
Ach, mein liebes Gott,
Frau Fortmuller said, and crossed herself. Liesel snatched her hand away.
Why don't you come with us?
The woman said.
I will try to help you find your family.
Liesel shook her head.
Na, Liesel!
Frau Fortmuller gasped at the rudeness, but the woman gestured away her protests.
You can stay here with Frau Fortmuller, who obviously cannot do anything to help you find your mother, or come with me, and I can promise nothing, but at least I will try.
Liesel scowled, and then finally she nodded.
It is settled, then,
the woman said, clapping her hands to her sides.
And,
she turned to Frau Fortmuller,
you can do your explaining to the Americans.
The journey from the children's home to Berlin was, for Martin, like a voyage to a foreign land. He had been nowhere and seen nothing in the year that he'd lived in the home. Herr Stupor's Sunday wanders were infrequent at best, and always led the children away from civilization, up into the hills. And like most of the children, Martin had arrived at night by car and never even seen the village. So the morning they left with Marianne von Lingenfels, Martin and Liesel followed her with wide eyes. Bedraggled white sheets and handkerchiefs hung from windows of homes. Left over from the capitulation, Marianne explained.
Have you not been to town since the Americans arrived?
Martin was suddenly embarrassed. How had they allowed themselves to be so thoroughly locked up? Other than the sheets on the windows, the village seemed untouched by war. The half-timbered houses stood intact, geraniums growing from their window boxes. An old stone church stood in the small square, and beside this a water pump fed into a stone trough. Two American soldiers sat in a jeep, handing out chewing gum.
Would you like to ask for some?
Frau von Lingenfels asked. The idea of asking the soldiers for candy struck Martin as preposterous. The dangers of America had been a great theme for Frau Fortmuller. In America, she warned the children, Germans had to wear swastikas on their lapels, just like the Jews had to wear stars here. She did not have to elaborate. Obviously, this was not a good thing. The day was warm, and the satchel that held Martin's belongings, three shirts, an extra pair of trousers, a well-worn Loden jacket Frau Fortmuller had dug up from God knows where, bumped hotly against his back. It was beautiful out, though. Dandelions and morning glories blossomed along the roadside, and the flowering rapeseed fields were a sea of yellow. Frau von Lingenfels, or Tante Marianne, as she wished to be called, led the children in silence. Martin listened to the wind whistle in his ears, and through the stands of trees between fields. The next town over, which was bigger, had been bombed, and a church steeple jutted from a massive pile of rubble like a decapitated head. American soldiers and German women worked together scraping up the remains, pushing wheelbarrows, shoveling rocks onto an army transport truck. When night fell, the moon was huge.
Tonta Marianne hired a farmer with an empty hay wagon to drive them to a town where she had heard there might still somehow be train service.
And on the back of this bumping, clattering vehicle, Martin allowed himself, for the first time, to close his eyes and fall asleep. When he opened them again, it was dark. People were everywhere. Young and old, women and children, soldiers still in their Wehrmacht uniforms, all sitting on piles of belongings, suitcases and boxes and dirty sacks.
He climbed off the wagon after Tante Marianne and Liesel,
stepping around an old woman on a stool, cradling an intricately carved wooden clock.
But he and Tante Marianne and Liesel were not joining the masses on this side of the tracks.
They crossed to the other side, in hopes of catching a train going east. The wrong way. Martin thought of Frau Fortmüller's warnings that the Russians were fierce, animal-like brutes who stuck German soldiers on bayonets and did unspeakable things to women. What? The children always asked, at which she would look aghast. They were going to find his mother. They were going to Berlin. If his mother was alive, though, Martin wondered why she had not come for him. But he didn't ask.
How were they killed?
Liesel asked Tante Marianne when they were seated on the platform, leaning against their bags. He knew who she meant. Their fathers.
That is no question for a child,
Tante Marianne said, her tone sharp.
But I want to know,
Liesel insisted.
Know that your father was a brave man, and that he did what he thought was right for his country. Was he shot or hanged?
Liesel persisted in a hard and unfamiliar tone.
Tante Marianne sighed,
a long, deep breath, almost worse than any answer.
Hanged, she said.
They were almost all hanged.
It was the first time Martin had heard it.
He squeezed his eyes shut and pretended to have fallen back to sleep. His neck began to hurt, but he did not stir. It was essential to pretend. When the train finally arrived, it was huge and violently loud. A freight train. Almost before its wheels ground to a halt, people hurled themselves at it, climbing hand over fist up the spindly ladders, scrabbling to the top of the open coal cars. There were only a few guards, all Americans, and they were busy unhooking the last car. One of them fired a few shots that whistled overhead. It was forbidden to climb aboard the freight trains, especially those hauling coal. It wasn't yet winter, but the predictions were already dire. Coal would soon be as precious as gold.
It's only the Americans,
Tante Marianne said.
They don't mean to shoot anyone. If it were the British, we would have to watch our backs. Martin liked her optimism.
When the train started, it blew her hair every which way. She looked younger and softer now. An old man passed her a flask, which she refused. But the generous spirit of his gesture was contagious. Another woman offered handfuls of raw oats. Marianne distributed a loaf of bread. The mood was jolly, even exuberant. Above them, the stars were so bright and three-dimensional, they seemed closer than the dark blots of towns and woods the train trundled past. Bombed church steeples, houses, and highways disappeared into an irrelevant jumble.
Your father would have loved this,
Marianne said, startling Martin.
He was always a troublemaker.
Martin was confused. The image of his father was becoming more opaque rather than less.
When he was a boy, Marianne continued, he took up boxing to rebel against his father, who was very stern and very proper. A Fledermann boxing? It was shocking. It would be like...
She groped for an analogy.
Like you taking up tap dancing.
Martine had never heard of tap dancing. It sounded frivolous, like something a boy should stay away from. Boxing, on the other hand, was manly. He gave up trying to make sense. He could barely hear her voice over the wind. Beside him, Liesl had fallen asleep. He let Marianne's words wash over him. She had loved his father. This much he understood. The train stopped at some point in the night. The tracks went no farther. The Berlin station had been bombed by the Allies and then flooded by the SS, who feared the Russians would use its vast tunnels to stage their invasion. Drowned bodies were supposedly still washing up onto the streets. They learned this from a grizzled old man who was eager to warn Marianne off. Liesl and Martin listened, half asleep.
"So we will walk,"
Marianne responded, unfazed. Both children did not protest. Martin's wonder at being free had worn thin, though. His feet ached, and the road was crammed with fellow refugees. In the gray light of dawn, the city's suburbs looked mean and haggard. Somewhere within all this crumbling brick, his mother waited. Martin tried to fill his mind with her, but found he could barely conjure her face. They walked all day through the suburbs and into the ruined city. They trudged down cavern-like streets piled high with debris. The fronts of buildings rose from the wreckage like jagged cutouts. Had the buildings always been so fragile? Like sandcastles taken down by waves? At street level, the remaining walls were covered with papers, scrawled names and messages. Martin could see Liesl staring at them.
"Missing people," she said in her defiant way. "Probably dead."
Makeshift chimneys rose from the rubble like waving arms. For the final portion of the journey, Marianne flagged down a passing American army jeep. At first, the driver shook his head without even looking at them. But the soldier in the passenger seat jabbed him with his elbow. He slowed to a halt and extended his hand. Martin hesitated before accepting, but the sores on his feet and his general fatigue won over his doubts. Frau Fortmüller's warnings about the Americans already seemed like something from another life. Marianne sat with the soldiers in front and spoke English, while Liesl and Martin huddled in the back. To their amazement, the soldier who had waved them in turned around and handed them a chocolate bar. And after that, for some time, all else fell away. There was only the unaccustomed sweetness of the chocolate, the slippery melting on the tongue. When was the last time Martin had tasted something so delicious? When they arrived, Mersteinstrasse did not look like a street where anyone could live. No more tall, speckled plane trees lining the curbs. No more lively café on the corner. No more gurgling fountain. But still, pockets of memory opened in Martin. The smell of damp stone, rot, and chemicals. The sight of people emerging from cellars covered in dust. The empty brass birdcage that hung in their shelter. The pee bucket in the corner. The horrible, glass-eyed elephant trunk masks. Marianne climbed out of the jeep and thanked the Americans. Still sticky and slightly dazed from the chocolate, Martin and Liesl scrambled after her. She pulled a crumpled envelope from her pocket and regarded it for a moment, before crossing the street to ask a group of women at a water pump for directions. The paper looked ancient and unpromising, but the script stirred something in Martin. It was familiar, his father's handwriting. As Marianne spoke, one of the women tried to fill a woven basket. The water rushed out through its lattices, but she didn't seem to notice. On her hip, a baby stared at Martin.
"Over there,"
another woman said, pointing to a building, if it could be called that. Marianne looked back down at the letter as if hoping for some other indication, before she led Martine and Liesel toward the remnants of number 27.
"Building is full,"
a Russian soldier barked as they approached.
"Move on."
To Martine's surprise, Marianne answered in Russian. A wide smile spread across the soldier's face.
"Ты говоришь по-русски?"
he asked. More Russian issued from Marianne's lips, and the soldier bounced on his heels like a delighted child.
"Yuri!"
he called, and soon they stood at the center of a small group of Russians, all grinning and slapping Marianne on the back.
"Vinita Flederman?"
Martine distinguished his mother's name.
"Ah."
The man nodded, his face sobering. More Russian.
"This is where you lived?"
Liesl whispered. She too seemed impressed with Marianne's Russian. Martin shook his head. Where he lived was not like this. The Russian gestured for them to follow. What had once been a courtyard was now piled high with rubble and crisscrossed by narrow footpaths.
"Don't fall,"
Marianne said as they walked. She was stern again. The freedom that had come over her on the train was gone. They followed the man through a doorway, down a black hall and up a staircase, climbing blindly. It smelled of mold and cabbage and human shit. Marianne's dry hand gripped Martin's hard enough to hurt. He was thankful for the pain. Without it, his body might disappear in the dark. Then there was light. A man sat outside a closed door beside an electric lantern. He was terrifyingly ugly, swarthy and scarred and low-browed, wearing the uniform of a Red Army soldier. At their approach, he pulled a rifle across his lap. He and the man they followed exchanged words, and with a terse nod to Marianne, their escort departed. The man outside the door was not moved by Marianne's Russian. He answered her in a short, guttural grunt that did not sound like any language Martin had ever heard. From behind him, a rich and salty smell of bacon wafted from the flat. Also, the sharp scent of alcohol. The man rapped on the door, entered, closed it behind him, and then reemerged, opening the door for them. Inside, men clustered around a table, playing cards. Martin did not need to speak their language to understand that they were amused. Was this where his mother lived? With all these men? Martin was confused. One wall was entirely gone, revealing the beams and brick and pipes and old bits of newspaper insulation. Water dripped from a corner of the ceiling into a tub. But the smells? Bacon and onions and maybe even butter frying? Were of delicacies he had not eaten in years. His mouth watered. Tins of beans and fruit lined the countertop. But where was his mother in all this? A dreadful feeling grew inside him.
"Smells of the devil,"
Frau Wortmüller would have said. There was an old woman at the stove, and a girl with bright painted lips and cheeks stood beside her, wearing only a grubby silk robe that revealed her scrawny chest, the breastbones like a chicken's.
"Where is Frau Flederman?"
Marianne addressed the old woman, whose expression shifted from hostility to surprise.
"Dear God!"
she exclaimed, looking at the children and crossing herself. On the stove, the potatoes began to smoke.
"I'll get her,"
the woman in the robe said. She stabbed her cigarette out on a plate. As she passed, one of the Russians grabbed her wrist and said something that made her laugh. Marianne was not amused.
"I will come too,"
she announced, shooing Martine and Liesl out into the hall. Back in the darkness, beside the frightening man with the gun, even Liesl did not speak. The electric lamp cast long, spooky shadows. Finally, the door of the flat opened again. The woman who emerged after Marianne was almost unrecognizable to Martine. glassy-eyed and thin and smelling strongly of perfume and sweat. She looked panicked, and her hands, long, white, and trembling, reached for Martin, fluttering over his face and hair and shoulders like a blind woman's.
"My boy! Oh, my boy!"
she said, dropping to her knees.
"My sweet child!"
Martin wanted to speak, to reassure her, but he couldn't think how.
"Oh, my boy!"
the woman, his mother, repeated, pulling him against her chest. And Martin could only stand, stiff as a board, trying to keep them both upright. Chapter 3. Frühlinghausen, March 12, 1938. The day Benita met Martin Konstantin Fledermann was unusually warm for March. It was as though they were in Italy or Greece, she kept saying, hoping it made her sound worldly, like someone who had actually traveled to such places, experienced such heat. Although, of course, everyone knew she hadn't, and they certainly hadn't been anywhere so exotic themselves, Frühlinghausen being what it was. It was the day of the Anschluss. 500 kilometers south, Hitler had personally driven to his birthplace, the little border town of Braunau am Inn in Austria, to announce the country's return to the Reich. The radio was filled with tales of cheering crowds, waving flags and throwing flowers, of people dancing in the streets. Frühlinghausen officials, eager to capture a little gaiety for the town, organized an impromptu celebration, a rally to be led by their own mayor and a local band. Who wouldn't want to celebrate the union of two populations of German speakers? It was a great theme for Hitler, and therefore for Frühlinghausen, which was thoroughly in support of the man and his party, the quest to unify all ethnic Germans across the continent under one flag. Benita Gruber was 19 years old and dressed in her finest Bund Deutscher Mädel uniform, a dark blue wool skirt and white blouse she'd saved her own money to buy. No longer the makeshift blue and white ensemble she'd worn for the first years of her membership, but the real thing, printed with the BDM monogram. She had braided her thick hair in two artful plaits and knew that she looked beautiful and healthy, the very picture of the celebrated Jungfrau, or German maiden. It was young women like her who had inspired Hitler's vision of the master race. She was meant to become round with child again and again, to populate the motherland with Aryan babies who would grow to be happy, healthy Germans, capable of hard work and loyal to their homeland. At least this was the idea propagated by Fräulein Briebel, the dower leader of Benita's BDM group, who had no children herself. And so, after coffee, Benita arrived at the town square along with her troop of wide-eyed Mädels. The mayor of Frühlinghausen was a rising star in the local Nazi party and was considered quite a catch. On that afternoon, at least among the girls of the BDM, there was a sense of Cinderella at the ball anticipation as they took their places before the podium. For all his promise, though, the mayor was neither handsome nor charismatic. His face was blubbery and wide, and as he spoke, rivulets of sweat dripped down his cheeks and hiccuped over his moles. But he was full of conviction.
"Today we usher in a new and important era."
He used an approximation of Hitler's own staccato, his words half lost in the wind, half swallowed by the stone walls of the 700-year-old church behind him.
"Today we embark on the road to a once again powerful and united Germandom."
Benita was bored. She had no doubt she could attract this trundlehead's attention. But what was the point? The very idea of standing beside him, let alone kissing him, was unpleasant. She imagined he smelled like sweat and mildewed wool, and beneath this, the pigsty. Like so many of the town's young men, he lived with his family on the farm they had operated with minimal success for the last however many hundreds of years. During the harvest season, he would be out in the fields alongside everyone else, pitching hay and sweating like a pig. Benita backed away through the small crowd, careful not to draw Fräulein Briebel's attention. Once free, she ducked down the little pedestrian allée that led to the old mill pond and Beidermann's Apotheke, where she could buy a bottle of the hand cream that promised to set her apart from all the other wash-powder-chapped girls of Frühlinghausen. For what? Who knew? For whom? Another good question. But the questions themselves excited Benita. She was destined for something better than Frühlinghausen. Then, suddenly, rounding the corner, Benita was confronted by the most handsome, most sophisticated man she had ever seen. He leaned against the wall of the mill pond, lighting a cigarette and wearing a good suit. Benita recognized this immediately. It was made of some kind of English wool, and the shoes beneath it were of shiny oxblood leather. He was tall and slim and unmistakably aristocratic.
"Sorry,"
he said, straightening and looking over his shoulder, as if to see whether he blocked her path.
"Am I?"
Benita blushed. "Oh, no, I just wasn't expecting to see anyone."
"Because they're all so engrossed in the mayor's brilliant oration."
She laughed in surprise. His accent was refined, high German, and his sarcasm was as un-Frühlinghausen as his appearance. "You were listening?" The man shrugged and took a thoughtful drag of the cigarette he'd finally managed to light.
"I was present."
They were both silent for a moment. Benita felt the urge to smooth her skirt, straighten the little neckerchief that had probably blown askew. But she stopped herself and stood still, staring back at him. "It's boring," she said, and her heartbeat quickened at her own recklessness. The man smiled.
"The speech or the Anschluss?"
"Both," Benita shrugged, feigning a sort of jaded sophistication. The man laughed. A jolt of fear snapped through her. Had she said something stupid?
"The Anschluss,"
he said, pushing himself off the wall he leaned against.
"It's not boring."
He extended his hand.
"Conny Fledermann,"
he said.
"May I buy you a coffee somewhere, and we can debate this?"
The touch of his hand was warm and dry, and sent splinters of excitement through Benita's veins. And his eyes were an almost eerie shade of blue. Not pale like her own, but intense. The blue of the North Sea in the sun, or of the tiny flowers that took over Frühlinghausen for a few magnificent days each spring. But how could she say yes? She was bound by her own lack of imagination. Fräulein Briebel and the other girls would be looking for her. It was Heimatabend, and they were to go directly to Olga Meisner's parlor for a piano concert following the mayor's speech. "I can't," Benita said formally and with genuine sorrow. "But thank you for the invitation."
"Why not?" he pressed. "You must get back to that boar."
"No," Benita blushed. "To my group."
"Your group? Aha."
He narrowed his eyes and gave her an assessing look.
"Aren't you too old for Hitler Youth?"
"Oh, it isn't that. It's Bund Deutscher Mädel," she said, surprised at his mistake. The man shrugged.
"Any of these groups."
He said the word with obvious disdain, and she blushed more deeply, feeling the full depth of the divide between them. "Goodbye," she managed.
"Wait, have I upset you?" he said. "I meant no offense. It's just my own..."
"Well,
never mind."
He bowed theatrically and doffed an imaginary hat. "It was lovely to have met you, fair maiden." That night, Benita tossed and turned as she lay in the dingy bedroom she shared with her two brothers under the eaves of the moldering, thatched roof of Gruber Cottage. Replaying her missed opportunity and the tantalizing possibility the man had presented. How had she let Fräulein Briebel's Heimatabend hold her back? This had been her moment, the chance fate had offered, and she had said no. In the face of this dreadful awareness, her family's cottage seemed particularly moldy and damp. The blankets on the bed disgustingly pilly, and the snores of her brothers as low and dumb as the grunts of sleeping swine. For the next few days, Benita sulked, spending hours on the weedy patch of grass behind the cottage, staring at the sky instead of helping her mother with the wash she took in. Even by Frühlinghausen standards, the Grubers were poor. Benita's father, long dead, had been a mason like his father and his father before him, primarily employed by the town's mental hospital, a dank, rambling establishment housed in a building that had once been a monastery and was in constant need of ramification. Their home was one of seven that lined the north wall of its grounds like a row of grubby barnacles. On quiet summer nights, the Grubers fell asleep to the moans and cries of the disturbed inmates. Of the three children still at home, Benita was the only one not gainfully employed. Her two brothers had found work in road construction through Hitler's four-year plan, and they were always quick to point out that Benita could find work through it as well. There was work for women. But Benita chose to assist her mother with the mending and washing instead. She did not want to commit to anything that might bind her to Frühlinghausen. Because for her real life, her real future, she would go to Berlin and find work as a typist or some such. She was sure of it, though she had never even handled a typewriter. And Frau Gruber indulged Benita's dream, much to her other children's irritation. Benita was her mother's favorite, the fifth of six, and the prettiest of the girls by far. Among her siblings, she was famously incompetent and lazy. Fallpelz was what her oldest sister, Lotta, called her, meaning lazy bones, and it was not intended fondly. The older children had each been sent to work at the age of 14 and raised on spotty potatoes and dandelion weed soup. Those were the desperate days during and after the war. They begrudged Benita's privileged status as a member of Hitler's generation, a cohort filled with pride and idealism, and most of all, with excitement about the future. Benita had little interest in politics, but she had absorbed the sense of possibility the new regime offered. And Frau Gruber, after so many years of hard and unemotive realism, seemed to have found in Benita's daydreams her own trampled capacity for yearning. She tolerated in her youngest daughter all the impractical nonsense she would have beaten out of her older children. So, it was fitting, in a sense, that Frau Gruber herself played a role in Benita's second encounter with Conny Fledermann. It was Saturday, market day, and Benita rose from bed with a grumbling commitment to help her mother buy and carry home their food for the week. Still in a sulk, she put on an old gray skirt and blouse and barely combed her hair. Who would she see, anyway? Ulrich Heschel? Manfred Becker? In the wake of her meeting with Conny Fledermann, the voice in her head had taken on a sarcastic ring. She trudged along beside her mother, whose stoic German peasant silence seemed to Benita a hallmark of everything dull and cold and lacking in her life. At the market, Benita dawdled, mooning over Frau Mühlmann's flowers and the artist's stall, until Frau Gruber returned, pulled at her sleeve, and reminded her that she was there to carry the wursts and flour and side of Salzfleisch. So when, rounding the corner of the cheesemaker's stall, Benita was suddenly confronted with the sight of Conny Fledermann, this time in full, handsome military garb. She was mortified rather than delighted. The horror of being seen so, in these awful clothes, carrying a bulging sack of smoked meats, and followed by her fruit-pinching, sniffing, hunchbacked mother. He, however, broke into a wide smile.
"Fräulein of the Anschluss," he said loudly,
causing a few of the passers-by to turn and stare. Benita's face went from cool and white to purple.
"I wondered if I would see you again."
Then he turned with an air of great respect and formality to Frau Gruber.
"May I introduce myself? Staff Officer Martin Konstantin Fledermann. I met your daughter here the other day, and we discussed the recent event of the Anschluss."
Frau Gruber bobbed her head repeatedly, like a deaf mute. Benita, still distracted by the bulging sack in her arms and the particularly ugly shape of her blouse, slowly registered the presence of two other men, both of whom appeared small and dull beside Staff Officer Martin Konstantin Fledermann. In the focused light of his attention, all else seemed obscured in shadow. But she thought she caught them rolling their eyes.
"This evening, perhaps? Can I take you to dinner?"
Benita stared.
"No."
His eyes twinkled.
"Yes," Benita said.
"Yes,"
he said, turning to Frau Gruber.
"Ja, sicher."
"Yes, of course," Frau Gruber said when she finally found her tongue. And her response was so unquestioning, so utterly lacking in parental restraint, that something in Benita snapped too. From that moment on, a subtle but profound shift occurred in her relationship with this man who was to become her husband. In the face of her mother's mute, girlish awe, Benita realized she would have to act as her own parental figure, creating the barriers and slips that made the game of courtship alluring. It was something she had never even thought of with the various boys of Frühlinghausen, who had made their interest known. There had been no game with them, no need for a game, and she had taken none of them seriously, had no interest in more than the affirmation their interest provided.
"Then I will pick you up at 8:30, he said. "At
7:30,
she said, cringing at the thought of him seeing the Gruber cottage.
"But 8:00 would be better," she added,
beginning her new strategy as obstacle maker.
"Aha!"
He looked satisfyingly surprised. Benita stood a little straighter and held the bag with less of an apologetic tilt to her shoulders.
8:00, then,"
he said with a bow. That evening, in preparation for dinner, Benita luxuriated in a hot bath. The Grubers still relied on the old-fashioned assemblage of water heated on the stove and schlepped across the kitchen to a tub that sat behind a makeshift screen. Frau Gruber, as excited as Benita herself, had suggested the bath and put aside her own work to prepare it. Her mother was, in fact, gripped by such nervous energy that it calmed Benita. She ran a comb through her hair and shook off Frau Gruber's offers to plait and wrap it around her head, in her usual Sunday style, and instead pinned it into a more modern American fashion, with three rolls at the base of her skull. Benita's younger brother made a racket knocking on the bedroom door and singing old love ballads in a falsetto. When 8:00 finally arrived, Benita wore her finest dress, a blue and red flowered dirndl that had originally belonged to her sister, and her two small Sunday shoes. She sat pretending to be engrossed in her needle-pointing as her mother arranged a plate of cookies and uncorked the plum schnapps in an embarrassing display of ingratiation. By 15:15 the hour, when Staff Officer Martin Konstantin Fledermann finally knocked, Benita had already experienced and overcome her nervousness, and she greeted him coolly.
"Staff Officer Fledermann," she said, glancing at the clock.
"I wondered if you'd been caught by one of Herr Schulte's dogs."
Frau Gruber's mouth dropped open at her impertinence.
"They tried,"
he replied with a smile,
but I was too quick.
Call me Connie, please.
With no further back and forth, and certainly